Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, CEO of the One Voice Movement Foundation. That's an international grassroots movement that aims to amplify the voice of mainstream Israelis and Palestinians, empowering them to propel their elected representatives toward a two-state solution. That effort seems all the more important in light of the recent breakdown in U.S.-mediated talks between Israelis and Palestinians, despite 9 months of negotiations spearheaded by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The talks have collapsed after Israel failed to release a group of Palestinian prisoners and continued settlement building toward the end of April. The Palestinians responded by applying to join a number of international treaties and announced another reconciliation initiative between Fatah and Hamas. This prompted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to formally end the U.S.-mediated talks, saying he would not negotiate with a government backed by Hamas, which does not recognize the State of Israel and which Israel views as a terrorist group. In a recent public address, U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East peace process, Martin Indyk, said, although the parties showed flexibility during the months of negotiations, each side did not feel, he said, quote, the pressing need to make the gut-wrenching compromises necessary to achieve peace. We'll talk with Mark Ginsburg, who is a former U.S. ambassador to Morocco and a well-regarded authority on the Middle East, about options for going forward, as well as One Voice, to what extent it can contribute to laying the important grassroots groundwork for a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And Ambassador Ginsburg joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center here in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Carol.
Well, Ambassador, first I'd like to get your take on the collapse of the peace talks mediated by the United States. Secretary of State John Kerry says they're now on a pause. He hasn't said they have completely collapsed. How do you view what happened?
Well, the fact of the matter is that Secretary Kerry deserves a lot of credit for investing the time and effort to try to bridge the gaps that exist between the parties. And he certainly gave it a significant effort, over 19 visits and a staff assembled by distinguished envoy Martin Indyk and a great team of people around him. The problem was not John Kerry. The problem is that the parties, that is the Palestinians and the Israelis, never evidenced from the very beginning the same incentive and desire to achieve an agreement that was commensurate with the secretary's efforts. And all of the issues that separate these parties that you and I know about that go back to the days of 1948 were never quite tackled. And instead, the parties got bogged down in procedural determinations over prisoner releases and whether Israel is a Jewish state and whether the talks should continue past a deadline that was artificially set. And so, in effect, it spiraled it downward out of control.
So where does that leave us now?
Well, as you said, Secretary Kerry indicated that this is a pause where both parties are going to regroup. But I'm sure that he has the best of intentions to see if it's possible to resurrect these negotiations. But I don't see, as a result of what has taken place when the negotiations collapse, that either party believes that there's a second or a third or a fourth thought being given to try to restore the talks to a basis that would lead to substantial progress. I think on the one hand, none of the parties want to accept blame for the talks' collapse. So as a result, everybody wants to take or at least create the fig leaf that these talks are going to continue. And neither does the secretary want to acknowledge that in the end, his efforts failed to achieve any success. But let's be realistic. There isn't any reason to believe that Mr. Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is going to change his views over the next few weeks on the issues that separated him from the Palestinians. To the contrary. And on the other hand, there's going to be a Palestinian election in 5 months if it comes off. So let's be realistic. There's very little that the Palestinian Authority president will negotiate before the hoped-for Palestinian election that technically is supposed to occur in October of this year.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about some of the impediments, because they're going to remain impediments, such as the role of settlement building. Special Envoy Martin Indyk did single that out as a major problem. So how can the Israelis reconcile doing that, knowing that this is a major impediment for the Palestinians and for the process?
It is interesting, because when Ambassador Indyk gave his speech last week at the Washington Institute, he essentially pointed the finger at the prime minister and the Israeli government for announcing more settlement construction just on the cusp of having him reach an agreement to continue the negotiations going forward. This particular announcement related to 700 housing units that would be constructed in a Jerusalem suburb known as Gilo, which by all intents and purposes, everyone knows would eventually become part of Israel under any final status agreement. And yet at the same time, settlement enterprise has accelerated significantly under the Netanyahu government, and particularly during these negotiations. And let's be clear, there's no one regime in Israel that is solely responsible for settlements. As much as we would like to believe that the Netanyahu regime is responsible, so was the Barak regime, so was the Rabin government. So a pall has been cast on the ability to construct a viable Palestinian state when Israelis are engaged in settlement activities that they know are adverse to the atmospherics, at a minimum, the atmospherics for a negotiation, and secondly, undermine the integrity of creating a viable Palestinian state. And I watched with sheer amazement the reaction from the Israeli government that came out a few days ago of criticizing Mr. Indyk for that criticism. Well, let me make it very clear. There's enough blame to go around on either side, but I certainly would submit that any Israeli official would like to pull wool over anyone's eyes and suggest that settlement construction had nothing to do with poisoning the atmosphere is peddling Kool-Aid.
Well, while we're pointing fingers, what about on the Palestinian side? Do you see anything that they did or didn't do that also contributed to the collapse of the talks?
Well, listen, insofar as the immediate atmospherics of the situation, it didn't help that Mr. Abbas declared his intention to seek participation by the Palestinians in these treaties, number one. Number two, I think what really was unfortunate is that, and I say this with the enormous respect and affection for Mr. Abbas, because I know him and I watched him on behalf of One Voice talk to 300 young adult Israelis that One Voice brought to the Mekadeh in Ramallah, and he couldn't have been more sincere, more forthcoming, more decent to these young Israelis about every final status issue. And it was written up in the New York Times. And I was very proud of what One Voice did here. But if there was one thing I would have advised him to do is not take the bait that Mr. Netanyahu threw at him over his refusal to acknowledge Israel as a Jewish state. It never has been part of the final status issues. And the more that Mr. Abbas talked about this issue, or refused to acknowledge Israel's right as to be recognized as a Jewish state, the more it created the impression among average Israelis that he was not truly interested in reaching a final status agreement with Israelis. So much of this has got to be built from the ground up, and public opinion has got to be mobilized to support or advocate or to push their government, in particular the Israeli government, into decisions. I would have preferred that he would have said something along the following lines. There's no doubt that Israel is going to be recognized as a Jewish state when we reach a final status agreement. But until such time, there's nothing that I should say or that I expect the Israelis to say that concede these issues until we reach an agreement. That's what I would have done if I were in his shoes, but he didn't do that.
He didn't do that, but at the same time, other critics say by requiring that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state, that that was going a bit too far, because Israel signed a peace agreement with Egypt, with Jordan. This was not a precondition.
Well, I thought it was a red herring.
And exactly.
It was a red herring. And I think Mr. Abbas should have, instead of taking it as seriously as Netanyahu was trying to get him to do, would have, he should have said, you know, we're dealing with Israel every day. And the fact of the matter is that Mr. Netanyahu is engaged in a diversion away from the final status issues. I will not let the Palestinian people be placed in a position where we create adversaries with the Israelis over an issue that the prime minister is creating just to create a diversion away from the true issues that need to be addressed.
Well, that's a good point, and you have to wonder why his advisors didn't advise him in this regard, or if they did, he ignored them.
Well, he said, I can tell you what he said privately, and he said publicly, that to acknowledge Israel as a Jewish state under the vociferous pressure, public pressure that Netanyahu is exerting, would in effect require him, Mr. Abbas, to forfeit his responsibility to Israeli Arabs, because it would in effect classify them officially in a minority status inside Israel. And my view on that was the Israeli Arabs have never expected the Palestinians to be their protectors, and this issue was never ever put forward to the Israeli Arab community as an issue that seemed to matter to them. So I guess in some respects it's a perfect illustration of false advertising leading to false claims.
We talked about these two problems, particularly the settlement building and this recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. But of course, Ambassador Indyk said fundamentally these are two parties which are simply not ready to make the so-called gut-wrenching decisions or compromises necessary. And that's where perhaps your organization, One Voice, comes in.
Carol, you're so right on that. We see the current generation of leadership as having to be incentivized to make the hard decisions and to want to lead their people, to lead their people into compromises that are necessary. There's no way, you and I know this conflict, and I've worked on this for 40 years, there is no way where hard compromises are going to be necessary. The right of return, Jerusalem, final status issue, borders, etc. Every one of these issues is just chock-a-block filled with emotion, history, morality issues, and yet at the same time, there is so much righteousness, decency, and respect that one needs to accord to these issues. As someone who is the CEO of One Voice, I perfectly understand how strongly Israelis feel about certain issues. I perfectly understand how much Palestinians feel that have been aggrieved by settlements and by the need to have some gesture on the right of return. And yet at the same time, One Voice is dedicated to helping that next generation of leaders understand that there are compromises that can be made and that they can be made in a way that is going to lead both people out of the conflict that each one claims they want to resolve, but it takes leadership to resolve.
Talk about the work you do on the ground and the kind of constituency you have. You talked about a number of Israelis, young people who spoke with Abu Mazen, with President Mahmoud Abbas.
We have a staff, a full-time of 39 people working in the One Voice Foundation in Washington and in New York, in London, in Gaza. We have an operation, believe it or not. I just was privileged to bring our Gaza executive director here on a speaking tour of Washington and New York. In 7 years, he's worked under the noses of Hamas. We have a staff in Ramallah, and we have a staff in Tel Aviv. In Palestine, we have what I would call a sophisticated, really committed network of 700 adult leaders throughout Palestine who work in day in and day out, engaging on what we call a retail basis in cafes and encounters on television, speaking on behalf of a two-state solution, as difficult as it is for them. They are really doing the courageous work of peace at a time when there's such disillusionment among Palestinians. In Israel, we have 1,700 youth leaders, most of whom are on the university campuses, but we're now expanding this outside of the university campus system. And those leaders in both Palestine and in Israel are supported by a really terrific group of board members who hail from a variety of sectors, from the communications, legal, business sectors, who provide them inspirational advice and counsel. And our job is to do a variety of grassroots activities and grass-top activities where, for example, in Palestine, during the Kerry Initiative, we launched a Wake Up for Peace campaign. We handed out small coffee cups around Palestine, and we held what we called Peace Cafe town hall meetings. In Israel, we launched a campaign which was an integrated media and grassroots campaign entitled Peace It Also Pays Off. It was a many hundreds of thousands of dollars in effort around the Kerry Initiative to convince younger adult Israelis that the amount of money that's going out of their pockets to support settlements and the occupation is money that could be spent on tuition, housing, cars, things out of their pockets. And we took billboards and media places and radio spots all around Israel to coincide with what we thought was going to be an extension of the negotiations. But our team is regrouping because we have really brought some pretty sophisticated initiatives, including we hired the former Obama campaign teams from 2008 and 2012, who are now gone back into private sector to do advocacy work, training for our teams in both Palestine and Israel, because we knew. Remember, One Voice was here before the Kerry Initiative.
Right.
It'll be here after the Kerry Initiative. We've been through every peace talks effort by every Secretary of State, and we watched them all collapse, and we've been there to keep that work on for almost two decades. And the number of people that we have trained who are waiting in the wings to take over an indication, just as an example, we created the largest peace caucus in the Knesset in Israel's history by bringing younger adults directly to advocate to Knesset members in a parliamentary democracy, where we now have 45 members who declare themselves to be member of a One Voice inspired peace caucus. And I know we need 61, but there weren't 45 before. And that's an indication of how we're approaching our work.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, former U.S. ambassador to Morocco, currently the CEO of One Voice. That's a grassroots organization that is pressing for a two-state solution. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and if you listen to PCUSA via the radio or the internet. Well, back to you, Ambassador Ginsburg, to talk about One Voice and the terrific work you're doing on the ground. You know, we hear about polls saying that both Palestinians and Israelis, the majority, want a two-state solution. But again, we see the collapse of these talks. We see hardliners on both sides somehow overshadowing these voices. And you talked about helping forge a new generation in Israel. I mean, do you see the numbers and their voices starting to become louder or as loud as the rejectionist camps or those camps who are continuing to press for settlement building, which we know is an impediment, et cetera?
Well, let's talk first about Israel and then talk about Palestine. The one thing I found in Israel is that younger Israelis are apathetic to a ne'er-the-well. In other words, they don't understand what exactly is on the other side of the security barrier anymore. The fact that that security barrier has so completely walled off Israelis from Palestinians has created an effect almost out of sight, out of mind and mentality. The Israeli public is increasingly comfortable on a more right-wing tilt toward to accept the current status quo is acceptable. After all, there's hardly any terrorism. The security barrier has separated the two parties. They're going for what I think most Israelis and most Palestinians are saying is divorce Israeli style.
Right.
It's not peace, I think, that anybody really expects. It's divorce that they want. And I use that word very carefully because I get the impression, after spending so much time on both sides, that in order to activate the majorities that theoretically support a two-state solution, they're going to have to be convinced in Israel by a leader who says to them, the status quo is not acceptable. The status quo is not going to permit Israel to remain as a Jewish state in the long run. We have threats of becoming a binational state. My leadership dictates that for Israel's future, this is what we need to do. They don't have that leader right now. And therefore, as a result, to the average Israeli, as far as they're concerned, what are they supposed to do under these circumstances? Because even if they theoretically support a two-state solution, there's very little ways in which for them to show that they're prepared to take to the streets. Well, they haven't really taken to the streets. The talks collapsed past, as I predicted, like a whimper in Israel. There was no great hand-wringing as a result. Now let's talk about the Palestinian side. The Palestinians are far more emotionally caught up in the ebb and flow of negotiations and what's taking place in this reconciliation initiative with Hamas and Fatah, and what the elections may portend for a future of a Palestinian state. They want a state. If they can't get a state through negotiations, they themselves are increasingly of the view, then let's just go to the UN and present to the Israelis a fait accompli, and then what? In some respects, I think Mr. Abbas, seeing the difficulties he's had in negotiating with the Israelis, is more or less seems to be set on that path. But what does that do? There's increasing acrimony on the street level between leaders such as our youth leaders who support a two-state solution and organizations such as the BDS movement. This is the Boycott, Disinvestment, and Sanctions movement that want to, in effect, boycott Israel, not just settlement, not just exports from settlements. But I think it's important for us to understand, again, looking at this through my eyes of having to deal with both parties, that BDS is a very dangerous movement to wind up supporting, because it's not that they're just supporting a boycott of Israeli goods. They're also interested in extinguishing Israel as a state. They try to hide that and camouflage that, but that's really their agenda. And before anyone gets caught up in BDS or in an issue of boycott, one needs to understand that they're as extremist as Hamas is in many respects.
Well, speaking of Hamas, and also you mentioned this unity initiative, let's talk about that, because theoretically it would be a good thing. But there's a major problem, because Hamas does not recognize Israel. But of course, Mahmoud Abbas gets around that by saying, well, we will form a more technocratic government and it should not necessitate the end of talks, that they would still abide by all past agreements. I mean, how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think it's important for our listeners to understand the sequencing here. First of all, there's supposed to be a technocratic government that'll be announced at the end of May, and that's supposed to be in office for 5 months. Then there's going to be these elections, and there's three separate elections. You have the Palestinian Authority presidency election, and you have the Palestine Legislative Council, and then you have the Palestine National Council. The first two, that is the presidency and the PLC, are elected strictly by an electorate composed of Gazans, West Bankers, and East Jerusalemites. The Palestine National Council is elected by the entire Palestinian diaspora. All the refugees, everyone who's a Palestinian in the United States, let's just assume for argument's sake that these elections are actually held. You could very well wind up having a situation, as some of my colleagues have suggested in our movement, where the Fatah controls the presidential authority, the presidency, the Palestine Legislative Council, but Hamas, because it's so much more popular among the diaspora, wins control of the Palestine National Council, which controls the decision-making authority of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Now, I don't know how Mr. Abbas is going to sell that to the world. Hamas has to do two things here to pass the smell test. It has to accept the quartet principles. That's number one. And it has to abide by the 1988 interim accord that was reached as part of the agreement that established the Palestinian Authority that the Palestinians signed. If Hamas doesn't agree to accept those principles embodied in both of those particular agreements and documents, they're only opening up trouble, I think, in the end for any future negotiation, because whether you're Netanyahu or Yitzhak Rabin, it's going to be extraordinarily hard to have the Israelis negotiate with a party that's now controlling a major decision-making body of the Palestinian Liberation Organization that is unwilling to accept the principles of the quartet or the 1988 interim accord.
Do you see any evidence that their leadership is moving toward acceptance of those principles?
No, I do not. Every time someone seems to tiptoe up to the margin and makes some sort of statement, it's immediately yanked back. Just the other day, a leading Hamas authority said, under no circumstances will we ever recognize Israel's right to exist, let alone give up the armed struggle. So I think that in the end, the proof will be, as we say, in the pudding. If we can't get Hamas to, in effect, accept the fundamentals, I'm not sure how anybody expects this to work out. Look, this is the fourth attempt to reach a reconciliation, Carol. And Hamas said, well, at best we'd offer, in Arabic, it's called a hudna, which is a 100-year truce. Well, like anything else, it's not just the Israeli leadership, it's convincing the Israeli public.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't look optimistic. Well, let's talk about, in the few minutes we have left, any kind of practical on-the-ground measures that both One Voice is engaged in, that the United States can help to promote.
We're trying to create facts on the ground. The other side of One Voice is called PeaceWorks. PeaceWorks is a corporate for-profit entity that is doing a major agribusiness initiative in the West Bank that's introducing all sorts of new technologies, including water technologies, to the West Bank. We are determined to create facts on the ground and to help Palestinians find the type of entrepreneurial enterprise that they deserve and need. And I'm a strong, passionate believer in that. And I'm so proud of the work that we're doing in PeaceWorks. This was started by One Voice over a decade and a half ago to create that. And we already have a factory that's been working for over a decade to create new food products and food processing capacities for young Palestinians. So we're doing our bit there. It's small, but you know what? It's going to be making a difference as it has made a difference. Secondly, we're creating a social media and digital media initiative entitled Partners Beyond the Wall. And it's meant to introduce to young adult Israelis that there are so many young adult Palestinians that want an agreement, want to be able to finish with the checkpoints, want to be able to travel to Tel Aviv, want to fly out of Ben-Gurion Airport, want to have a decent life and deserve it. They deserve to have a state that they can be proud of and can help build. And just as Israelis need to come to understand that there are really talented, well-meaning, respected young Palestinians that they can befriend and understand. I mean, when I go and meet with the Palestinian youth leaders around Palestine, as I have, I can't help but be honored and impressed by their courageous commitment to recognizing that the only future for Palestinian nationalism is a two-state solution that's negotiated, not a two-state solution that's arrived at by every party deciding what they're going to declare as their unilateral measures.
Mark Ginsburg is the CEO of One Voice. That's an organization dedicated to mobilizing civil society to support a two-state solution. Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, thank you so much for your eloquence, your analysis, and best of luck with
One
Voice.
Thank you very much for having me, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.